Gay Talese is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, of course, is here. All of these stories, as I read your, may I call it a memoir? Your story.
That's no, that's
better.
Fine, a memoir. I mean, that's what Barnes & Noble will call it.
So oh, well, then.
Stick with them.
All these stories, you just have this astonishing gift. I think it's the gift of your father, the tailor.
What it is a story.
Is the
it's
story
a true story about
within
you.
The story, within the story, and the elegance. It really did remind me, as if it were one of your mother's evening gowns, yeah, or your, one of your father's
three-piece
suits.
Connectedness.
And you do it the way your father made these suits, with in the dark, in the quiet, with a needle, one stitch at a time. And then you leave it to me to see the whole of it, which is gracious on your part, that not only will you give me the stories, you're going to let me participate. Do you think of me as you're doing this crafting with your pieces all over?
Well, you are in my present thoughts as those women in my mother's store were always in my present thoughts as I eavesdrop or as I communicated silently with them. I did not speak to them. My mother did whatever talking was to be done. But I did sense and appreciate the presence of people I did not know, and I was very interested in what it is they said about themselves and, parenthetically, about the community. They were not chroniclers. They were not reporters. They were not Joyce Carol Oates. They were there as ordinary citizens, but what they were speaking of was extraordinary to me.
And
I believe then that the ordinary can be extraordinary if you know it well enough. Or
and
you
then
listen
you did it
well
in
enough.
Selma, and then you did it with the mob. And then this taking, it's almost like a, I probably will mispronounce it, a pointillist, an impressionist painter who's going to give me all the points, and then I can see the picture as it unfolds.
Well, all after I left the newspaper business, I only had one job after I was introduced to it as an office boy. Then I went away for a couple of years to the Army, and then after I returned in 1956, I was given a job as a reporter. But first 2 years of my 9 years as a staff writer, the first 2 years were in the sports department. That's where the opening was. And I didn't want to write sports events so much as people who were sports performers. It mattered not to me whether they were prize fighters, baseball players, horse racers. You know what? I didn't care. Tennis players. But I really wanted to know their personal story. Everybody had this story. Where they came from. What influenced them. How did they persevere when they were disappointed with the performance, or they lost their job, or they were replaced on the team, or didn't make the team, whatever.
Everybody has these stories.
Well, and persistent people, too. And then when I left the newspaper business, I did for 1 year. That was 1965 to 66. I took a 1 year contract with Esquire, and that's when I wrote about such people as Frank Sinatra. I had a deal where I would write six pieces in a year. And the first one was about a person that I used to observe in the city room when I was a newspaper man on the Times. And he specialized in writing obituaries. He was an obituary writer. His name is Alden Whitman. And I thought, there is Mr. Bad News. Everything he writes is bad news. Somebody died yesterday. But what he do is this, he was an eccentric-looking gentleman with a very, very, he had a little mustache and very thick glasses, and he would peer with almost a constant squint through those glasses as he was scribbling down the final words and testament of somebody very important. But I thought, there's an interesting job. So I was able to pick my stories more or less. And the first one I wrote for Esquire was Mr. Bad News, about this man who wrote about the death of others and contemplating his own death, and how would it be written. The second one I wrote was about Frank Sinatra. It was called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. But I never talked to Frank Sinatra. But what you mentioned before, you talk about those people around him. You don't have to talk to what is the obvious star. Rather, those that are in the reflected starlight of the star. A person who was in the band, perhaps, while Sinatra is making a record. Or someone who might be the valet of Frank Sinatra in his home. Or someone, and I did write about this, a woman who would carry Sinatra's hairpieces in a satchel as he traveled from location to location. And
a critical position for Frank Sinatra.
That's right. I mean, these people had stories to tell and what they were talking about Sinatra, but it wasn't that one-on-one, the obvious, you know.
And nobody asks those people.
And that's a pebble. And that's the way of, and then when I wrote about the, Joe DiMaggio, but it, he didn't even give me an interview. But again, I didn't want, the newsmaker wasn't all that essential to the way my head works or the way I think it works. Is to do what isn't so obvious, the people that are in the history or part of the history or reflect the history, but the historians would ignore, the great Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. They have a sense of power. They write about the people of prominence. They write about people you've heard about, at least, more often than not, that say have to, because their whole careers are based on assessing historical figures or writing about people who are making history. And today they'd be writing about, you know, who's the general in Iraq or the policies of the Bush administration or whether Karzai and Musharraf are going to survive and all this. I wouldn't want to do that, and I made that point heavily.
But you do do that.
Not with those people, I don't.
But you do it all the way around.
But it's off the main course. It's on the side streets of life. I'm always on the side streets, not the main street. All the little – my first book was about – it's called New York Serendipitous Journey. It was published in 1962. And it was about people along the side streets of a big city. And the next book, called The Bridge, it was about a bridge building, but it was a big bridge, very big bridge.
Verrazano Bridge.
The Verrazano Bridge in between Brooklyn and Staten Island and the city of New York. And I watched those men who were building at high altitudes. And they were like the same people I wrote about in Serendipitous Journey. They were ordinary people. You never knew their names. Their names were not emblazoned on a plaque on the base of the tower of the bridge. But they were great, you know, great. And the Kingdom of the Power about the New York Times. It was all those odd characters. I mentioned one of them, the obituary writer. And then the mafia was the wives and the bodyguards and the children. And then us in the other book, Thy Neighbor's Wife, is about all these frolicking people that were, in my definition as a Catholic growing up and as an older boy in that town when my mother ran the bookshop, were the people who personified sin, and then later on, sin was defined differently. What was wrong was not always, you know, didn't have that definition when I was growing up. And then the last book was about immigration, and this book, A Writer's Life, it's the same look, an alternate view of history, an alternate view by alternative people. That's what it is.
It seems to me we can't understand an event or the things or series of events if we don't understand the context in which they occur. And what you do, have done, and you know, it seems what you're describing is to establish the context that everybody else ignores. And I say that partly, I think that's a fairly accurate representation. I say that partly because as we've gotten ourselves into this manic news cycle, that contextualization has fallen away. We get less of it probably now than we've ever gotten. And it seems as if without that context that we're just dealing with cartoons and caricatures, which is a very dangerous way to see the world we inhabit, and in some senses boring.
Well, I like what you said. I acknowledge that probably there are some people listening to finding me boring, but they're stuck with me as long as they stay tuned in. But what it is that I am affirming about what you said is that I don't think it's boring what I write about. But what I write about isn't to suggest that it's unfamiliar to the reader. It's just some of the people I write about are unfamiliar. But the situation, let's take, I went to the University of Alabama, as I've already said.
You didn't say that. Why you went to the University of Alabama.
Right, we'll get to that. But I went to the University of Alabama, and I graduated in 1953. And I had friends there. And then, of course, within 10 years, Alabama's making all the headlines, along with Mississippi, as being the center, or allegedly, using that newspaper word, allegedly the center of racism, because all the people in the South took the brunt of the attack. I mean, the white people of the South took the brunt of the national attack upon racism. And it was said that the whites personified what was wrong with egalitarianism and racial prejudice. Well, I was born, as you've heard five times already, in New Jersey. What I didn't tell you before I worked in my, well, I didn't tell you that although I worked in my mother's store and all that I said before, I was aware when I was 10 or 11 that there was a Klan, an active Klan.
As in Ku Klux Klan.
The Ku Klux Klan in Ocean City, New Jersey. Why do I know that? I saw them. I saw the white sheeted people on certain occasions, usually on weekends. They'd make an appearance on the boardwalk, and they had meetings, actually in one of the movie theaters. And sometimes my father would say, you know, I know who some of those people are. And one of them was the leading pharmacist in our town. Now, there was no protest against the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan. It was just there. There were blacks in our town. We had a ghetto. It was like a little Harlem on the other side of the railroad tracks. I grew up with this. I wasn't one of those persons protesting, oh, how can we be living in this racial society called Ocean City? I just took it, you know, I was casual about it. A kid grew up with it. And when I went to the movies, there was a black, on the balcony were the blacks, New Jersey again, and the whites were in the orchestra part. That was the Village Theater, the only theater that stayed open the year round for movies. So when I went to Alabama as a student, I didn't see a lot different from New Jersey. Then when I left Alabama and started as a reporter, and then in the 1960s was among those reporters occasionally sent to the South to write about the burgeoning, the rise of civil rights, the rise of the names like Martin Luther King and John Lewis and a lot of others, many of them who would be in the Freedom Rider period, and others would be beaten up, and we all know about that. I was then, in 1965, in March, I was among those many reporters sent to Selma, and I happened to be there on the side of the road on March 7 of 1965 when Bloody Sunday occurred. That was the time when the protesters, all black at that time, were trying to march from Selma, 54 miles away, to the capital of Alabama, to Montgomery. And in the course of moving some paces outside of Selma, they were accosted on the road, on the side of the road, by a surging group of state troopers, Alabama state troopers, and sheriff's posse under the notorious and heralded Sheriff Jim Clark. And I watched all this. And I did a little story, and everybody wrote stories, and it was on television, and it was again and again played because the Bloody Sunday incident was very visual. There was smoke rising, tear gas, people crying out, you know, billy clubs and rifle butts banging against the heads of the black protesters, or demonstrators, actually. And I wrote my story, and then there were many, many other stories as the march was prohibited for a while, and then the law allowed it, and then it culminated some weeks later in the march reaching Montgomery, and later than that, the Voting Rights Act was enacted by Congress under the Lyndon Johnson administration. And then I left the paper, and I did all these other things, but I kept wondering, that story's not over yet. Yes, the march is over. Yes, the Voting Rights Bill was carried off by the... And people sang We Shall Overcome, but that story is not over yet. And I kept watching the end of that story.
Which will continue when we return in just a moment with Gay Talese.